I think right now is probably as healthy as position's been in terms of a player development standpoint in a long time. And what's changed over the years for me is I think at this point when in development, say you take an amateur player through the process, I think that first couple of years remains the same. Creating patterns that they can duplicate every single pitch unless they decide to change it. And then from there, there's a ton of other techniques that you can employ to get the guy behind you reacting to what you're doing. And that's the exciting part. So
you're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
Broadcasting from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, welcome back or welcome to our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, your baseball coaching source for certified audio gold and the place where you come to connect with the very best baseball minds in our game. Man, what a time to be alive and a baseball fan. There's so many great things that are happening out there for our game. And one awesome thing that just happened even a few seconds ago, you chose to hit play. Seeking out information to learn from others, challenge where you're at in this game. That's what you did when you chose to dive into this podcast, and you're in great company here. Thanks for checking out the show, and thanks for helping us positively change the culture of coaching around the world. We appreciate that. Always with the reminders on here to subscribe, review, and share. Make sure you're subscribed to this show on your phone, your computer, your tablet. Leave us a review on iTunes. 5-star ratings always help more baseball folks find the show. And then the share, how important that is to jump the action gap, throw out a tweet, send out a group message, connect more people with this show, and much love to each of you out there helping us with that. Connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at ABCA1945. Head over to our website, abca.org, if you're looking for more information about what our baseball coaches fraternity here at ABCA is all about. And please feel free to reach out to me directly at CoachSheets3. Or by email, Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at abca.org. Let us know how we can help. We love connecting with more coaches. And we also hope you saw the release of this fall's ABCA Barnstormers Coaching Clinics Tour as we're hitting the road from coast to coast. We'll be in Boston and New York, L.A., San Francisco, New Orleans, Jacksonville, Phoenix, Nashville, Houston, and Fort Worth as we rally the troops to come join us in Dallas for our 2019 ABCA National Convention. Now, these are one-day coaching clinics. We're going to be on the field and getting dirty. You know, I'm going to go ahead and put this out. I'm calling for a pop-up slide at some point this fall. Don't know when it's going to happen, but just get ready. It'll be all over social. For more information on our upcoming Barnstormers Coaching Clinics Tour, head over to abca.org/clinics and jump on the tour bus with us this fall. Now, our loyal listeners know that this podcast is supported by our great friends over at AstroTurf, the leaders in the clubhouse for the turf industry. And we decided to check in with one of their proud clients, Justin Hare, the head coach at Campbell University here in North Carolina, to discuss his experience with the no-mo, no-grow, no-H2O solution that's really transformed his field. So let's check in with Justin. Always great to connect with one of my favorite guys in college baseball, the head coach at Campbell University, Justin Hare. Justin, thanks for jumping on the call with us.
Nah, thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate it, man. And that's probably the first time anybody's called you Jeremy in a while, so I wanted to stand out to the people.
I know you did. It made me feel a little icky right there, but I appreciate that. I need that on a good Tuesday morning. Let's open up with this, man. I'm just interested how the season's going. How's everything going? I'm playing a lot of games at home on that AstroTurf surface, but how's the season going so far for you guys?
Yeah, so far pretty good. Some up and down in the non-conference right now. We're right at 500, 16-16. We're 9-3 in conference and Big South play, tied for first place. You know, out of 32 games, we've played 24 at home, you know, and with how the spring's gone with the weather and the rain and the snow and the cold, man, we've certainly been fortunate to have a AstroTurf surface and haven't missed any games, haven't had any cancellations or anything like that, which is a huge benefit, not only to gameplay, but just for practice and preparation as well. It's a big time game changer for us and our player development.
So how many tarp pulls have you guys had?
exactly zero for 2 years in a row now.
Oh,
so
boy.
Our guys are the ones that have been around long enough to have had the natural surface and the tarp poles at 6 a.m. are real thankful to have the AstroTurf field.
Well, like you said, this has been an unseasonably wet spring, especially here in the Midwest and the East Coast. And I know there's a lot of guys out there that wish they had an AstroTurf surface. So certainly hearing from your perspective, not missing a game, especially there at home, is a huge nod to what's going on. Now, if you could, I know Jim Perry Stadium and the renovations you guys have done there are just off the charts, and you're only about an hour and a half away from me. So I've seen it up close and personal, but just take our listeners through the renovations that have gone on there and the specific surface that you guys put in there on the playing field.
You know, over the last 6 years or so, we've done about $5.5 million of renovations to our facility. Mm-hmm. Specifically over the last, 18 months, we put in about $3.5 million into our facility. We built a new building, the Jim and Daphne Perry Pavilion down the third baseline that houses our locker room and coaches' offices and a training room, all top notch, about 7,000 square feet. We've also added about 300 chairback seats down the third baseline, built all new dugouts. In that renovation, we also added the turf field, which is, just an absolute, blessing and super fortunate to have. We also added a state-of-the-art Daktronic scoreboard or video board, that's one of the biggest in the state, the biggest, video board in the Big South Conference. So we essentially achieved a 5-year facilities plan in about 9 months. So as hectic and as crazy as those 9 months were, it certainly paid off. The facility is gorgeous. The AstroTurf playing surface is it's top notch, top line. Stuff looks fantastic, and that's one of the draws of having the turf is being able to it looks great all the time. It looks great in January, looks great in July. It's always ready to go. It doesn't matter from a recruiting, from a player standpoint. Man, I'll tell you what, it has been the capper on this renovation for sure.
That's outstanding. Now go into this, because this is always a question that comes up, especially with coaches that are interested in looking to put an AstroTurf surface on their facility. Comes back to the wear and tear. So if you could talk through maybe the wear and tear spots, how you're maintaining those, and then also maybe what repairs have you done to that field?
Sure, sure. The biggest wear and tear spots are essentially the home plate area, the batter's boxes, the catcher's box, and then kind of around the bags where you do a bunch of sliding, where you dive back in a bunch at first, when you slide into second a bunch, and any area where guys stand a lot. If your first baseman or third baseman kind of plays in the same spot, you get some wear and tear there. But there's no field cutting, there's no fertilizing, there's no overseeding, obviously. It's essentially just getting the infill, whether it's rubber or a sand rubber mix, kind of back in those low areas, where it's been pushed out. So it's really, our guys spend about 15 to 20 minutes at the end of every practice or the end of every game, kind of replacing the rubber or sand infill in the boxes and kind of in the slide box areas. And then about once every 3 weeks, we basically take this gigantic broom behind our gator, and we basically drag the entire field with this broom to kind of level back out any areas where we've got some buildup. It takes 30 minutes max, once every, 2 or 3 weeks, just to kind of keep it fresh and keep that infill leveled out. And other than that, the daily maintenance isn't an issue at all. Now, we also have the high A affiliate for the Houston Astros played here last year and play here again this summer. And so we have an abnormally large number of home games. I mean, we have about 105 home games every year on top of any summer tournaments or any travel ball tournaments that come through here. So last year we developed a little hole in our catcher's box and our right-handed batter's box. And, AstroTurf came out and they replaced the entire box, both the left-handed, right-handed, and catcher's box area for us this winter to get us kind of ready for the spring. And, that turnaround time was fantastic. The customer service was great. They communicated with us. They knew our timeline. They knew how quickly we needed to have it done. In fact, one of their installers came out. He canceled and moved around one of his other appointments because we needed it done in a short period of time, and we had some weather coming in. They've just been fantastic to work with. Obviously, a first-class organization and, you know, the best turf company in the country.
That's it. Well, there's a reason they've been ahead of the curve for almost 50 years, and certainly what they've done there at your facility has been off the charts. If you're interested in seeing some pictures, you can go to Campbell Athletics online. You can go find them on Twitter at GoCamelsBSB. Justin, thanks for jumping on the call with us, preaching the great word about AstroTurf, and we wish you the best of luck the rest of the year, my man.
Thanks, Keith. I appreciate it.
There it is, coaches. And if you want more information on how AstroTurf can transform your field, head over to their website, astroturf.com. That's astroturf.com, and find out why AstroTurf has been ahead of the curve for almost 50 years. Now, how fitting is it that our last few shows have seen us transition from pitching, where we connected with three of the very best teachers out there, to connecting with Bruce Brown, as we talked about leadership on last week's show, to now this week talking about catching. Couldn't have worked out any better. Following up from his A-plus presentation at our Indy convention, we decided to go get Tim Cousins, the field and catching coordinator for the Chicago Cubs, to get back on a call with us and take a deeper dive into his thoughts on training the exaggerate with his catchers, truly simplifying his approach to finding daily improvement, and walking us through the inner details of how the Cubs are tackling player development. So heads up, listeners, this show was recorded with Tim watching a baseball game. So you're going to hear some cheers, some baseballs fine in barrels, a little bit of wind. But inside this show, you'll find some real nuggets from Tim that I think you can bring back to your programs. You can change the way that you're going to view receiving, blocking, throwing, and the intangibles that we work to teach behind the plate. I've got my shins on. I got my chest protector clipped in, Scully flipped. And let's drop the mask with Tim Cousins from the Chicago Cubs. He's our guest on this week's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. And get ready, coaches. This great show is coming at you right now. Coaches, thanks again for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. We're going behind the dish for today's episode. We're going to be talking with the field coordinator and catching coordinator for the Chicago Cubs. We're going to welcome in Tim Cousins. Tim, thanks for jumping on the call with us.
Thank you very much. Honor.
We're excited to have you. Now, we just saw each other a few months ago out there in Indianapolis, Indiana for our 74th annual ABCA convention. You jumped up on the main stage and did a fantastic job talking through catching, one of our most well-received presentations. Can you just kind of go through your ABCA experience, talking in front of 6,000 coaches, what that was like, and just about your time there in Indy?
Well, actually, the build-up to the presentation was for a long time, get me to do the convention, and for me it was a matter of time. And so when I finally committed to doing it, then it was a lot of time after that presentation. And of course, as soon as I was getting ready to do the presentation, we had the fires in Northern California. It was literally in my backyard, so to speak. And then on top of it, I got the flu, that weird flu. So I had the phone in my hand twice. I was going to call and cancel and flew out to Indy. And really, really glad that I did it. It was everything that everybody told me it would be, and in a lot of ways, really, really valuable for me. So it was a great experience, and way different than I anticipated. It was massive.
Yeah,
it was way larger than I anticipated.
Sure. Well, you again did a fantastic job. I know we were talking earlier today. So as a coach and being an 11-year member of the ABCA as a coach, I got to sit there and sit through every presentation. There's very few speakers I ever missed as a convention goer. And now my third year here at ABCA, I don't get to see any of those presentations. So I'm always playing catch up and try to get to watching the video. So watching your video in prep for this podcast, this interview, there's a ton of stuff in there that I want to go into. And I think we want to revisit because it's certainly 40 minutes on the stage. We can get a little bit deeper here on the podcast. But before we do that, if you could just give our listeners, those who were there, those who weren't there, give them an overview of your presentation. And what was your goal with this particular clinic?
For me, I think the goal was to make it as digestible as possible. I think the tendency for any instructor is to maybe overshoot a little bit. I was really trying to get fairly basic with the information and get things that I thought coaches could take away. And unfortunately, being a rookie to the speaking engagement thing, it just flew by and left a lot of meat on the table, so to speak.
Sure.
So it was designed to be very simple and hopefully very useful information for guys that are training catchers guys that are trying to build on some easy concepts for you know, amateur players to grab onto, so it becomes more repeatable and easier. So that was the design. And, you know, like you said earlier, as soon as you get up there, it's a wash of movement, it's a blur, and it goes really quickly. So there are some stuff that we could there's some things that we can absolutely tighten up to this conversation.
No doubt. Well, I think one of the coolest parts is, as I clicked in the video, was your pump-up video, which completely threw me for a loop. I was going to see some big-time highlights, some guys throwing people out. Instead, we saw guys getting crossed up, guys wearing it in the cup, and certainly some errant throws. Great way to really accentuate the point that we really coach for TV moments, but there's thousands of those that happen. And certainly, as the youth in high school and college and professional coaches paying attention to this, they can resonate with those things happen a lot more than the big time moments. But I think for our listeners, Tim, give us just your career in baseball. You did such a great job summing that up pretty quickly in your presentation. Just give us your career in baseball that led you to the position you're in right now with the Cubs.
Well, my path was, I think, similar to most coaches' paths, which is, you know, I had a fairly nondescript playing career, played for 8 years in the minor leagues, had some injury history, and you know, after I got done there, I was in the bullpen 2 years in Kansas City, and that was very valuable. That was a time to breathe and not worry about what was happening on the offensive side, just dig in defensively. And I think I've always known that I wanted to be in player development. I think that was kind of a sweet spot for me. I knew I was headed in that direction. And so I quickly made that transition and had an opportunity to manage. And from there, it kind of mushroomed a little bit. Mm-hmm. I managed for a couple of years. You know, got out there and realized that I found that I was staring at the catchers a lot more than anything. And so I just quickly made a right turn, went into the catching. And I've been really, really happy that I have. It's been an unbelievable experience thus far.
Let's go a little bit off our script here. Let's go back into this question. We're talking about being the field coordinator and the catching coordinator. Certainly, like you said, player development. That's something that's really got your attention. That's where your meat and potatoes are in terms of your daily outcomes and output. Go into that idea of really talking about development, because, you know, we were talking earlier, one of the key terms that comes out when you talk about the Chicago Cubs is culture. So certainly within your culture and that organization, development has got to be integrated somewhere in there. Can you open that up a little bit?
Yeah. So, the backstory is, 2012, I came over from the Marlins. A good personal friend of mine and a guy that I've worked with for forever, Brandon Hyde, who's now the bench coach, was the farm director. And so we literally went together, and we were fortunate enough to dive deep into this, and it was a blessing. And so we had pretty much carte blanche to create what we needed to create, and things kind of fell in line quickly after that. We're proud of our culture. Everybody talks about our culture, and that's, I think, the most gratifying thing for us personally, is that people have connected with, you know, what we've tried so hard to create. It seems to be working and evolving all the time, so it's been really fun.
That's cool. If you can't tell, guys, Tim is actually can't get out of baseball. He's got to be at a baseball game. He's got to have it in his blood. But I think that's a great backdrop for this conversation as we dive into a lot of things specific to the game and specifically to catching. And so where I want to start with this entire conversation, Tim, comes back to the beginning of spring training. The new Major League Baseball season, you guys just got out of that spring training element. And just go into what that looks like for your catching corps. What's the approach? What are the desired outcomes that you're looking to do each day with those guys?
Yeah, so I think anybody that's ever caught realizes, no matter what you do in the offseason and how you prepare, I think that the minute you get down to spring training, everything kind of feels foreign, it feels alien. So it's about creating routines and getting guys back into, you know, rhythms that their bodies remember and getting them back on the right page. And so that process takes, with our guys, it takes usually about a week and a half to 2 weeks. And once you get the guys going that direction, then things kind of, you know, mushroom off of that. So things are wide open at that point.
How are you kind of on ramping their development? Like, it's certainly them coming off what they've done the off season, and you trying to get, I would guess, everybody in essence back to a common starting place. How do you on ramp them into the intense workload they're getting ready to walk into for 162 games?
Well, I think that the thing that most people see right away is guys do not come in out of shape.
Sure.
Guys come in from all these facilities
everything has been ramped up all offseason. They're in a good spot.
Mm-hmm.
There's just that element of getting back into the routine, the physical part of it, the routines that they, you know, that when they're in playing shape, it's easy for them. When they come back, no matter what you do, it's always a little out of sync. So the process, in my opinion, has shortened over the years.
You
guys come in and they can get up and running pretty quick. And I think you can burn guys out quick if you try and overdo it. And if you use the time wisely in spring training, that's a bulk of time to get guys going. I think that's where you get the best results.
Gotcha. Can you take us maybe a little bit deeper inside of the practice plan, maybe the specifics of what, if we were a catcher in the Cubs system, what our first week might look like specifically, but then how do you progress? And then I think kind of piggybacking that entire conversation would be, what are the cues? What's the language? What's it smell like and taste like down in your catching area in terms of how you're really coaching these guys?
Well, one, our catching area, which we are also proud of, is probably one of the most outrageous practice areas in the country. You know, the one abuse of power being the field coordinator and the catching coordinator is our machinery and our spots are pretty outrageous. So we have a great space, and we're able to accommodate probably 25 catchers easily, all active all the time, with no problem. We have a tremendous catching staff. We have a very deep, very knowledgeable catching staff by design. You know, we have about 7 or 8 former catchers that have all played at different levels. A lot of them played in the big leagues. We're healthy on that front for sure. As far as how it smells and tastes, it's a morning routine, and we like to call it, hitters go in there and do soft toss every day. And I think it's really, really important for young catchers and professional catchers to get the daily work, not the taxing stuff, but the daily, the daily workload that, creates these routines and habits that are ingrained in them physically. So it just comes out automated. The first week, to answer your question, first week we're in cages. We're grinding out a bunch of drill sets. We do transfer stuff every single day,
Okay. Regardless
of what we're doing. We do transfer work every day and fixed base stuff where we're not moving our feet. We're just taking the ball from the park at, out of the glove, separating the leather from the leather. We do that every single day. And, of course, we do, equal parts receiving, sinker-based, always with spin, never, if it's down the middle, it's a changeup. Other than that, it's left knee, right knee, and then depth of reception, all that stuff every single day of spring training.
In terms of feedback, I'm curious as a personal question. How are you delivering feedback to those guys? Again, like you said, they're coming in, they're in shape, they've been training, but you've got to get them in line with the vision for what the Cubs have for them and what they want from their catchers behind the plate. Is that a one-on-one conversation? Is there video to back every conversation? Is that an office setting? How are you guys delivering that feedback for your guys?
That's a great question. So every player in our system has a player plan. So a lot of the defensive goals that we have for a player come straight off of their player plans, what they're currently working on and what they're trying to eliminate from their player plan. So, a lot of those conversations are sit-down conversations in my office with the guys that we're making adjustments. That are coming right off the page. So they know exactly what they're working on at all times. And then we go out and execute physically. And then we just try and just beat it in submission, go out there and make a weakness a strength.
Sure.
Through a ton of reps. And a lot of times the reps can be misleading. When I say we do endless hours of receiving, we do, but it's in a controlled environment that's not, overly taxing guys and taking the bats away from them, so forth.
A lot of youth coaches and high school coaches and certainly a lot of teachers that are inside that group. So they're hearing individual development plans, IDPs, I'm sure. But give us an example of what that might look like. I don't blow off script here, but just give us an example of what a change in a player that comes in, what might be on his plan that you're looking to maybe drill out and move him in a better direction.
Well, it's inclusive. So there's stuff on the mental skills side. There's all kinds of categories that comprise our player plans. Our stuff in particular with the catching stuff gets, I would say, extremely detailed in terms of individually what each guy is working on. Things go on and off there all the time, but the bulk of it comes from all departments of development.
Okay.
So the player has a full access and input to his player plan, and it's you know, it grows all the time. So I think that's the best way for us to keep track of the gazillion things that these guys are working on. It's a way for both the player development staff and the players to keep track of where they're at. Because it can get a little heady when you're out there in, say, you know, Pawtucket working on something, and you get kind of lost in the shuffle, and it kind of funnels you in the right direction.
Right.
So,
well, no names, but can you give us a specific from the catching realm? What might show up on one of these plans?
On a defensive side, for example, you know, actually, quite honestly, for most of them, stride length, what I'm doing, it shows up on a lot of them. Guys that can't control the right foot, and therefore they can't control where the left foot goes,
yeah,
which is so vital to success for guys throwing the ball with accuracy and release point and all that stuff. So that generally shows up a little bit because until you see it with the veteran guys, they have the ability to control that left foot. Where it's striking, between the feet, all that stuff, the release point's going to be different because the left foot's striking in different spots. And so that's typically one of the things that would show up on the player plan. Recovery, we talk about recovery, you know, not only blocking, but we talk about recovery more than blocking. That shows up a lot.
Yep.
Maximizing the athleticism, consistent throwing stroke, you know, relationship with fingers to the seams, all that stuff shows up repeatedly early on in the player plans for most young catchers. And then as they go, you know, it melts away fairly quick. The one thing that I think people mistake in the industry is that catching is hard to develop. I think catching, honestly, is one of the easier things to develop if you identify the right kind of characteristics you're looking for defensively, because of the workload. You know, the workload is so great, and there's so many reps involved that quickly, once you get guys on a good page and you kind of have a repeating cadence physically, all of a sudden, the rhythm takes effect, and guys develop quickly. I understand what people are saying when they say, I get that, but I think if you get a college player or a high school player and you look at them a calendar year later, I think that the improvement is drastic in most cases.
Wow. Okay. That's a good discussion topic for us. I guess, and again, this will be the last question off script, but have you had experience, I'm sure, drafting a player and maybe he didn't fit somewhere positionally and they've said, hey, Tim, we really need this guy to develop into a catcher behind the plate. Have you had that? And what maybe it's a story inside that of truly what that development looked like for that specific player?
Yeah, you know, over the years, I've had a few guys that there was some question marks in terms of where they were going to play. You know, going back career, you know, Austin Barnes was an infielder that we were trying to find a home for. You know, there's been a control, obviously, with Schwarber, so, you know, that's a whole conversation in itself.
Right, yeah, it is.
You know, I mean, that one's close to our heart because we, you know, because of the makeup and stuff, but people will never really truly see what he was capable of doing defensively.
Sure.
And that's a shame because the left hand was the lead call and all of that. This stuff is off the charts. I mean, that's a whole different thing. Throwing would have been outstanding. I mean, there's a lot of things that people would have been surprised about had he stayed back. I'm on a tangent now, but I've had my fair share of guys that there was question marks about guys staying behind the plate. I've had guys who were 6'4", 6'5", that, you know, can they stay behind the plate and so forth. So yeah, like I said, I think it's one of those things that people think is a little more difficult than truly I think it is, and I think guys can develop rapidly behind the plate and really surprise you, guys that you wouldn't expect that can make, you know, defensive leaps, but it's very doable behind the plate for sure.
You know, you talked about in your presentation, Tim, you talked about the unique blend of physical and non-physical, and you talked a lot about posture. And I want you to kind of go into that in terms of, you know, you had some great thoughts about how even using your fungo example, man, that made sense in terms of keeping that consistent throughout everything that you do, whether that's receiving to blocking to throwing, but expand upon posture and how important you think that is behind the plate.
Yeah, posture is one of those things that you see mature athletes have.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they sweat through first to achieve that or if it was something that was prefabricated and put in and then repeated. When you see those kind of players, those kind of athletes, whether it's a catcher, a shortstop, a center, when you see those kind of players, that the body control, all that element is on, and when you have that, then you're dealing with a different bag of inefficiencies. You know, when a guy has that, it's much easier to move them from one place to the other in terms of the workload, because everything builds off of that. And when you see a guy that has that, it's unbelievably valuable in terms of somebody repeating something. And especially when you take catching, you know, into the conversation, you're talking about doing something from an unnatural position and something that's really physically difficult. And then you add the non-physical part of it, who the fourth receiver is and all those things that we talked about in the presentation, then it gets a little, it can get a little tweaky. It's very easy for people to say, you know, what is this guy thinking about back here? When in reality, he's fighting posture, he's got bad lights, he's got spots in the stands, he's got girls in the stands trying to impress, you know what I mean?
There's a lot of things
that if you don't have that stuff on autopilot, it's very difficult to get the look at a player consistently enough to deduct whether he can or can't play back there. So the posture, one guy's posture, it's the most important physical thing that, that you have at your disposal to ramp you up or really annihilate you. So to pay attention to it right away and start chipping away those things from day one is one of those attributes that we talk about that, that in my opinion, doesn't take that long to develop. Because I think as an athlete, as a human, I mean, when you hit those leverage points and you can control your posture, it makes so much physical sense and things happen so much easier because I don't think you'll ever forget it once you get to it. Just addressing it right out of the gate. Everything that we do is based on that. We have a battery of rules. We have a battery of tests that we do with players as they come in to identify if it's a strength or a weakness. There's a lot of things that, you know, that we go into that quickly focus everything on that. And once you get to a place of posture and understanding all that, then, you know, it's a pretty quick move after that.
Let's go on a different route. Let's go about receiving a little bit. And I thought there were some great points to be taken from your talk when you talked about length versus width. Certainly the left-hand relationship builder, I think that's a great concept in terms of what that left hand can do between the catcher and the umpire. But there was a lot about eliminating head movement, which, again, when you talk about length versus width, when you talk about the importance of the left hand and what it does, and then the head movement and keeping everything as simple, especially with the body and letting the left hand really do its work. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, so the length versus width thing initially back when I started was one of those things that I think was a little funky for people to comprehend because it ran so closely into thumb diving and winging.
Right.
For me, I cut my teeth in a different era of receiving. You know, it was all length, head behind the pocket. You know, there was a little sway involved. There was all these things. And as I got to a place where guys were, you know, had big velocity and big sink, it was just a loss of movement that really, you know, difficult to control and contain and all that. So as I transitioned out of home and I was in the bullpen in Kansas City, I was still catching major league pitchers, Roberto Hernandez, Jason Grimsley, had huge sink, Jeremy Affeldt, all these guys that had their plus stuff. And I had the ability to slow it down and get the workload without going 0-for-4 and getting pissed off and all that. So
right.
So I was around at that point. The active catchers were Brent Mays and AJ Hinch, and those spectacular catching guys and loved the position. And we had the ability to kind of spitball some ideas. And so those 2 years were unbelievably valuable for me in terms of carving out this concept of length versus width and how far I could go before I had to roll the thumb and catch the ball. And then from there, the concept of catching balls and receiving strikes and having the maturity to know the difference comes into play. You know, if you put your hand in, you know, using the width and you move the arm, well, now the width becomes really usable. And the aesthetic of a strike for the umpire, which is the reason we work on everything anyways, becomes much different. And the sleight of hand stuff, all that stuff comes into play, and then you're on top of the communication style of umpires. All those things are thrown in when you're talking about guys getting a bigger strike zone than others. And then, you know, the width thing, initially, you know, there's some kickback. But as we've been doing, in fact, as the receiving metric stuff has shown up, the data has kind of hammered home that point that guys that use the width to their advantage typically score fairly well with the receiving metrics.
Right.
So, you know, I think a lot, you know, now there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. We could talk for 17 hours, but a lot of the stuff, you know, with the hinge, you know, of the glove that we're so blessed to have that other guys didn't have, there's some good and there's some bad. There's some some hand mechanics that are involved with the hinge that allow us to receive the baseball with one hand that guys didn't have, you know. So guys, in turn, now have gotten, I don't want to say lazy because that's not the right term, but guys have gotten accustomed to doing things poorly pre-pitch and then making up for it with the hand. Whereas when we talk about our receiving, it's the arm that moves the pocket of the glove consistently and letting the ball close the glove versus just getting beat and then make up the difference with your hand and, you know, catch the ball and then kind of drive it back towards the strike zone. That, you know, I think everybody's seen that for years. And then to finish the thought with the head movement, all of those things started happening naturally after you started addressing using the width of the glove and trying to eliminate all head movement and just move the eyes independently of the head. And all of a sudden, when you start mastering that ability, all of a sudden you really start seeing the baseball easily. And the movement is not compounded with your head moving at the same time. You know, that's the separator. When you move your eyes independently of your head, you see everything. And if you have a guy with good movement, nobody's saying you're not going to move your head a little bit. Mm-hmm. But if you can kind of get it, you know, control of the movement that is unnecessary, really helps. One, it helps you as a receiver because you see everything. And two, all of a sudden now, the umpire feels, you know, 9-7 with nasty right-handed sink with no movement. You know, there's an absolute aesthetic to that reception versus the head jam, you know, body sway, working as hard as you can to pick it down and then pull it back. So, and then, you know, of course, the benefit of that is all of a sudden now after that, after you control the head movement, all of a sudden you've controlled your transfers. And when you can control your transfer, all of a sudden your throwing improves. So there's a thousand benefits to kind of calming down the animation of balls that are over the plate. That was one sentence, by the way.
No periods. No, just a few commas.
Yeah.
You know what's awesome, though? You're talking about, you know, the quiet body and really the arm, the glove, the only thing that are moving. And that presents a much clearer environment for the umpire to get his view of, like you said, 97 with hard sink, as opposed to really working and swaying with the catcher. So that makes complete sense. And I think it goes right into this next question. We're, to your point, we're in the era of velo and movement. That's been over the last 10 years. You can look at the numbers in terms of what the starter velos look like, the bullpen velos look like, and a ton more movement. I guess, how have your previous thoughts, even as a player, the guy down there catching bullpens and guy working in the game, how have your previous thoughts about catching and your approaches and the things that you would cue, how have those changed over time, especially catching up with today's game?
You know, the one thing that I, being reflective on where I've been and what's happening, the one thing that I think I'm the most excited about is the fact that things, and I don't want to say that things have changed and that, you know, it's evolved. And
yes,
what I'm excited about is the thing that's the best about our position right now is there's a lot of attention on our position, which is fascinating. And there's a thousand things going on, and there's a lot of ideas, a lot of things happening, and a lot of it's showing up because of the attention that people pay on the receiving metrics and all that stuff, and that's incredible. So it's like spurring on this detail of the position that I think all coaching guys are excited about. You know, I think it's very exciting. I think we're in a good spot. I think on a whole, the industry is taught very well at this point. There's some outstanding, you know, catching guys, outstanding young catching guys, unbelievable icons in the position. I think right now is probably as healthy as the position's been in terms of a player development standpoint in a long time. And what's changed over the years for me is pretty much, I don't want to say everything, but I will say that I think at this point when in development, say you take an amateur player through the process, I think that first couple of years remains the same. We call it ultra vanilla. We talk about creating patterns that they can duplicate every single pitch unless they decide to change it. And then from there, there's a ton of other techniques that you can employ to get the guy behind you reacting to what you're doing. And that's the exciting part. So taking, say Wilson Contreras, for example, taking him through the process, a guy who is unbelievably gifted in terms of athleticism and what he can do and how tooled up he is. It was, for him, it was about taking him and making things simple and eliminating some movement, excess movement, in order to get to the purest form of what he's doing, knowing that at some point he's going to have to go back and add some of his, movement and extra sauce, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So taking guys back and making things simple, like we talked about in the presentation, the analogy I use is out of a G chord for a guitar player. Having somebody be able to stand on stage and hit a G chord in time in the band, it is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a session with 9-7 with bad lights and a weird drawing stroke from a pitcher and being able to clean that up with no movement, that's all I have. Until you get a catcher to that point, you're going to be on skate back and you're going to be getting different results with the same pitch for the entire season. And that's a rough spot for a catcher to be in. So it's about creating this really ultra vanilla approach. And once they master that, and they do it, they'll do it fairly quickly because, like we talked about earlier, the workload is so great and the skill work, the repetition is, there's so much of it that it becomes ingrained much quicker than, say, a guy taking a drop step on a ball that runs from him. You only get so many of those, but you can get 200 sinkers in one day that rip off your left toe. and how you figure that out, is ultra important. So,
right.
There lies that thing we were talking about. Like, the workload is the separator. We get tons of it. And if we use that time to our advantage and we pay attention to the things that make us successful, then it's a fairly quick process to get some results. So, all of those things we're talking, I know we're blabbing, but it's
good.
Those things that you start out with. And as far as the theories haven't changed for me. I think my mind is opened up to acknowledge and understand that throughout the course of a game, at a high level, at some point, you need to employ different things to get the result.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, you'll get a kick out of this. I was talking about metrics and how advanced we are in the game. I was talking with the Division I pitching coach this afternoon, and he brought up the fact that the beauty of those metrics and TrackMan and the different things that allow them to see pitches and where they were in the zone helps them now coach the catching side of things, because now they can figure out what was a strike, what was caught and brought into ball territory, and a call they didn't get. And he was like, so we can sit there and break those numbers down to a science and say, man, if we can keep it around 3 or 4, we still got a chance to win that game. Hopefully those aren't big moments where they really impact the score or impact what's going on. But, man, he goes, we've had games where he gets into 10, 11, and 12, and it's hard to come back from that. It's hard to combat the fact that we've lost pitches, we've lost strikes inside the game, no matter what the moment was, and it seems to really compound itself. Do you see that happening as you guys really get to start to explore these metrics?
Yeah, it's funny when you start looking at the numbers. One of the things that I think has changed the most is the ability to do all those things.
Mm-hmm.
To look at those, go in nightly and review everything and watch everything and see what's happening pitch for pitch. I think that's when you start getting these huge nuggets of information, more specifically with the receiving. And our whole goal on the receiving side early, up through the A-ball levels, it's about pitches that we're taking away,
mm-hmm.
versus pitches that we're actually getting. And then flipping the script on them as they get to double A and triple A. Up through the high A ball levels, it's about pitches that we're not boxing.
Sure, yeah.
About pitches that we're not flushing, that we're not getting, versus pitches that we actually are stealing, so to speak.
Yeah.
I got to tell you something. I'm pretty pumped. Can I go off script here?
Yeah, heck yeah. Come on, man.
I am literally, I've had one of these chaotic days. I'm standing here watching my nephew through a fence, a hole in the fence, because it was so loud over there. I could tell it was too loud. So I came out here, we did some hitting yesterday. And he just laced an RBI single with 2 outs. So I'm pumped. I'm like not whole gang, looking through the fence right now.
I love it.
Awesome. So, anyways.
Perfect for our podcast. I'm telling you, that's money in the bank right there.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of the desire for metrics, you made reference to this. If somebody would track spin rate, we're doing it on the mound, we're doing it with breaking balls and fastballs and how we're creating life on the mound. If somebody would do that behind the plate, which leads us into throwing, because you talked a lot about spin, which is awesome, the carry to where we're throwing. And what are the coaching points inside of throwing for you? Like, what are the cues that you use, especially guys that you're trying to create better spin or more true spin? What are you using with them?
Yeah, so, you know, the spin rate for a catch, I've been screaming at for years. Somebody's waiting to do that pronto. Somebody's got to have it already. Somebody's hoarding it. I know it.
So we need to share that.
That stuff, the throwing, I know that's the stuff that we need to be sharing. The throwing stuff is one of those things in the presentation that after I got off stage, I was mad at myself for not taking the advice and, you know, getting through things a little bit quicker, because that's where I think most people would really dial in and want to know about. And for me, throwing is a sequential thing. It absolutely is a God-given gift, the ability to spin a baseball. And as catchers, we typically outrun our inefficiencies with the ability to spin a baseball. Mm. And we have gearings as catchers. You know, we have a really good relationship between our fingertips and the baseball and the gearings in between to make a throw back to a pitcher with moderate velocity and easy carry versus, you know, fire coming out of the fingers as we deliver a ball to second base. I mean, there's gearings in there that are different. And so when people talk about catchers mastering their throwing and catchers throwing KPP and all those things, there's some relevance to that because of those gearings. In terms of how it's done, I think there's a wide range of things that you can get to that will really, really help your throwers. And the one for me is if we can picture this, is left shoulder versus line. Like when I was taught it was, you know, shrink and grow the feet, left shoulder on line, right hip on line, looking over the left shoulder, that was considered a straight line. And I would encourage guys to kind of delve into that a little bit differently and just think of the left shoulder creating the line in whatever is natural. So if you're standing square to the pitcher, or in this case, square to second base, and you turn your left shoulder independently of your head, your head's not going to move, but your left shoulder is. When that left shoulder gets on line to second base or very close to it, unfortunately, that's really all we have. And if we can do that consistently, we'll create a pretty consistent path for our arm to travel, and then more importantly, our fingers to deliver the baseball. But what happens is guys over-rotate their left foot comes up at the four hole, their shoulder is over-rotated, and then from there become super rotational instead of very linear. And I think things, you know, break down because of that. And then all of a sudden the head leaks to create a good throwing stroke, and then we just, because we're getting spinners, we kind of manipulate the ball and get it to go where we want. I personally believe the only thing that truly gets online to where we're throwing is your right foot and your left shoulder and your eyeballs. Yeah. If those things are in line, and again, going way back to head movement, if you can eliminate the head driving down, you know, transferring the baseball, looking back, and then head and eyes traveling back to movement, which is the middle of the field where we're throwing it, I think it's too much. I think if you can lock your eyes on where you're throwing very quickly after the reception, I think if you can create a straight line with your right foot and your left shoulder, I think you're in play. And then you have, you know, you have your trunk underneath you, and you have distance between your feet. And then I think you start getting into, you know, accelerating the baseball versus decelerating, and that's when we get into problems.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, and I like the way you described that in your presentation. Blocking, because I know this is a key element as well, and you talk about the fat man chin versus the bald spot. I have both, so I don't know which one we're going to go with, but
I actually showed mine.
You did. Bless your heart. Well, I had one and I took all the hair off, so I just went straight bald, so you'll never know where my bald spot was. But I know how important blocking is to you. Dude, you made some fantastic points inside this talk about blocking specifically, and it really comes back to posture. So I know that's a key coaching point for you, but also want you to talk about the recovery. And you made reference to that earlier, the ups that you guys do and how important that is. Just go at blocking.
Yeah. So going back to posture, it's the ultimate deep dive into posture. Mm-hmm. And when we have it, when we block, we have the ability to recover the baseball much more quickly than we would is if we, you know, spoon out over the ball, look straight down at the ground, make a collision with the baseball on our body, and then try and get to our feet, recover the baseball.
there's no ability to create any explosive athleticism. Some guys can, the unicorns can, but for the most part, those over spoon blocks are with runners for hours in spring training. I know when we talk about what we do in spring training,
yep.
We spend a lot of time trying to be the best in the world at identifying, you know, balls that are going to be in the dirt and exploiting that. Mm-hmm. So what we try and do in the system is we try and combat that by being the best in the world at recovering the baseball. Blocking technique is something that we talk about literally for a day, and then we never talk about it again. I think every player that you get has some semblance of a sound blocking technique, cleaned up by hours and hours of standing blocks, which we sort of got to in the presentation. Mm-hmm. And all that does is it gets you in your hips and gives you posture as you go to block the baseball. And all of a sudden, you're blocking the ball higher in your chest protector, and then you're able to move to recover the ball.
That's right.
And then mastery is, of course, where you watch a guy and you go, how in the world did he block that ball, and two, recover that ball so quickly, and how did that guy not advance?
That's right.
Those, I think every two of those should be an IBI for the catcher.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that later. How about every five kill blocks is an IBI?
Exactly. Oh, that's good. Get your charts ready, boys. I love that drill with no mask. And in terms of going to block, now certainly that is a super controlled environment. That's the best of the best. You've got A+ machines for the coaches that are part of our association, Tim. We do give them personal liability insurance. So if you do want to attack no mask blocks, but what I equated that to is this, you'll understand this correlation here. So you're doing a blocking drill with your catchers. They have no mask on, and it's really keeping their posture. And more importantly, it's showing that by keeping their posture, their head doesn't tuck. We don't see the bald spot. They keep their chin up, and the ball literally lays right in front of them, and they can up really quickly. I equate that to a couple years ago. Head coach at Coastal Carolina, Gary Gilmore, has been 6-7 years ago, spoke at our convention about bunting and certainly wanted to get his guys to get their nose behind the barrel so they can see the pitch better and get it on the end of the bat so they wore a catcher's mask. So it's the complete opposite of that, but you're really training. You're getting out of your player what you want by creating an environment that they're forced to do that. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And the thing about the no mask blocking is – a couple of things. We're trying to create as athletic of a collision as you can.
Yeah.
And understanding body control and posture. And by taking the mask off, you're really just tapping into some human nature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody's going to throw their airways in front of the baseball. So they're literally going to push their chest out, which eliminates the tendency to look straight at the ground. Mm-hmm. It gives you a fat man chin. And it gives you a very clean line to a baseball. And so when you do it immediately, and I do work with a few catchers in the off season, as young as 8 to 10 years old. And conceptually, once you see that they have enough athletic ability to pull this off, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
Immediately from 10 years old to say, all the way up to Major League All-Stars, there's massive value. In terms of posture. And then what guys do is they eliminate the extra move to get to the line.
That's right.
It just becomes in the line of the baseball. And no, not angling, not overspooning balls, not leading with your limbs. That's a major one. We'll talk about that in a second. But those things are concepts that quickly, again, we talk about human nature. And when you feel something happening easy and natural, just like the posture we talk about, that's one of those things. And then all of a sudden it becomes less about the block and it becomes more about the recovery.
That's right.
I think when those things switch, when you switch those on an athlete, I think it's, you quickly move through the stages of blocking, which are, running into the baseball with the limbs. And then, then you're trying to attack some athleticism to get to the ball after. And then 5 years down the road, then all of a sudden you get some posture. You realize how really simple a block should be in concept,
mm-hmm.
Versus how hard we typically have tended to make it, which is, and I'm not saying this is wrong or right. I'm not controversial in any way. I'm not mm-hmm. trying to be controversial, but we're trying to take away the arm lead completely.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when you watch the standing blocks, the elimination of the arms is the thing that gives you the posture. But what happens is a lot of guys throw the limb into the line of the baseball and their body's lagging behind. And what we're trying to tap into is having the posture and athleticism and explosive movements enough to move, to propel your body left or right or even down the middle to get in front of a baseball and let your limbs play catch up. You know, where limbs will enter, you know, they'll always enter fast because they're always going to be faster than your body, but they're lagging. And when they lag, you put your chest in front of the baseball, and then your arms, as they separate, then you have some ability to move from the block to the baseball.
That makes total sense.
So, really good. I know that's one of those things. I can hear the coaches. What, you're not going to go arm first? That's in, you know, we talk about training the exaggerate.
That's right.
That's one of those exaggerate training things that when you watch it, you'll never eliminate completely the arm initiating some types of blocks. That'll never happen. But if you can put that in an athlete's consciousness, what you can do is you can train their ability to move their body in front of the baseball. That's truly what dictates a block.
Well, that's it. You said training the exaggerate to gain minimal improvement. So let's go above and beyond.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
No doubt. That's where the nuggets are.
I love that.
Just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to, you know, improve just a little bit each day, you know, throughout the course of your career, hopefully it's, you know, 20 years long, you're talking about massive gains.
That's it. Go into everyday drills. You made reference to this and you went through a few in terms of mainly it comes back to a lot of receiving, a lot of transfer, how important those are. But what are some of those maybe go-to everyday drills and routines that you have for your guys? And do you have a specific routine or do they have one each and every day?
Every one of our catchers has a specific routine designed for them in their pursuit of the improvement we're looking for. And some of it, you know, it really just goes back to a normal coaching blueprint. You know, some guys struggle with hitting their target in their corner turn. So all the receiving stuff designed with minimal and early quarter turn. You know, transfer stuff for other guys. You know, it's pretty specific to each guy. But I would say the bullet point drills for all of our guys are those standing blocks. I wish we had time to get into our transfer stuff, because I think it's those kind of things that everybody enjoys seeing.
Right.
You know, creating a relationship between your two hands and your fingers versus your whole hand on the transfer is a revelation when you talk about throwing. You know, we didn't really get into that too much. Those things are, you know, a staple drill. Like I talked about, spin. We do a lot of cross velocity stuff. Visually trying to confuse athletes is massively beneficial. So with all the machinery that we have, creating cross velocity receiving drills, people can see it. It's insanely beneficial. And it's fascinating what, you know, back in the early days when I started out, we had some lab rats, you know, you know, we were creating this stuff, and what guys can also do that, you know, wasn't done prior was just, it's fascinating to watch what talented athletes can do visually. And I think when you challenge them on those levels, then all of a sudden you start seeing massive gains in their ability to sit back there, trust their setup, you know, squat with their hips, not their knees, and let the baseball get to them, and then combat that nasty movement that we face every night. 87 left-handed cut, you know, the 97 sink, the straight downhill, you know, that stuff, like we can contain that stuff now because you can replicate it when you do your training. And so we do a lot of that stuff, the cross velocity stuff. And then, you know, like I said earlier, those recovery drills that we didn't get a chance to. It was weird, kind of a weird environment. We were going to do that up there, but that's a weird stage and kind of an unpredictable surface. So we didn't really get into that stuff, but there's some pretty, unique athleticism up kind of stuff that is huge for athletes.
Now, I guess when we're talking about evaluating catchers, and let's just stay specific to those guys, relative to their individual development plan, but how they're really moving through the course of that season, but their career, and then overall, when you're taking that 30,000-foot view of evaluating your catchers, how do you define success, Tim?
You know, it's funny. This is going to sound like an ultimate cop-out. And the time with the catchers and watching guys,
Some of them, you know, rocket ride development, others slow, steady grind. Success for me is watching a player come in that has no catching theory, that's just a very physical piece, and come away understanding the position, truly understanding the position, like what you're doing physically, like what you're doing mentally, what you're doing situationally. Like when you watch those guys make those games, that's success. Mm. When you have guys that take their abilities and elevate those abilities, now whether or not they're major leaguers or not, that's not, in most cases, they have the game. That's kind of the end result. Mm-hmm. I think as long as I've been in development, I think truly understand when I started that, you know, I don't think I had any idea of what truly development it is or was at that point. Right. And truly over these years, like refining, going back and chipping some things away and understanding things a little bit more and understanding truly the definition of what player development is and what it means to not only an organization, but a player. Those are what keep you in the game, in this capacity.
Okay, Tim, you've made it this far. I got one more question for you. This is the one we always ask on our show. And just empty your pockets, man. What other advice do you have stuck in there that you want to offer to any coach paying attention to this? How would you send them down a better path?
You know, that's a great question. I think if there's any advice to give a coach that is trying to take a player from one place to another, I think we live in this. I don't think I'm one of those guys that doesn't think that players aren't going to do the work and they're purposely trying not to do the work and that they're different and this and that. I don't believe in that really. I think it's our job to stimulate something in every player that provides to inject information that you know will help a player. And it's finding that whatever that little avenue is, that little end is, I think the best coaches are those guys that find that end, that vein to get something into a player that you know will help them. And then subconsciously on a lot of level, does the trick. I think that's the art of coaching. And I think anybody that doesn't continue to look for that and acknowledge that, I think it's going to be very difficult transition for a lot of those guys. I don't think any coach has ever goes through the process and is one way his entire career. Mm-hmm. I think we evolve, and I think the good ones find multiple opportunities to evolve, find different avenues to connect with different players and different, in a lot of cases, different areas of players.
Sure.
Because there's coaches out there that coach for, a long time, and it's important. The good ones seem to continue to find that vein to inject that knowledge and to get those players to get both feet on the ground and get going in the right direction.
You dropped a line at the end of your presentation, which is so fitting for this show. We talk about the guys who pay attention to this podcast and are members of the ABCA. They're lifelong learners. They realize they had to challenge themselves each and every day they're at the ballpark. It's not stealing if you give it back. And I think that accentuates this group and accentuates what our coaches are about. Tim, man, I cannot thank you enough for jumping on our show. I hope you're enjoying the game, man. We enjoyed connecting with you, talking through some catching stuff, getting some great knowledge we can take back to our programs and our players. But, man, we appreciate you jumping on with us. Thanks for what you do, and we wish you the best of luck this year.
Thank you very much. I had a blast. Any time. I'll do this anytime you want. This is spectacular. Thank you.
Thanks so much for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast and connecting with these great coaches. If you're interested in more of these shows, check us out on iTunes, hit subscribe and dive right in, or head over to abca.org/podcast and scroll through all of our episodes. A huge thanks again to the great folks over at AstroTurf for sponsoring this podcast. If you're looking at doing any upgrades at your facility, head over to astroturf.com. That's AstroTurf.com and see why they've been ahead of the curve for almost 50 years. Now, here at the American Baseball Coaches Association, we're here to serve coaches around the world, so let us know how we can help. Head over to our website, abca.org, for more information. Make sure you're following us on Twitter at ABCA1945. You can find us on Facebook as well, and feel free to reach out to me directly at any time on Twitter at CoachSheets3 or by email sheets, SHEETS, at ABCA. ClubHouseSportsNetwork.org. We'd love to hear from our loyal members and continue to find ways to keep growing the game together. As always, coaches, thank you for listening in and staying dialed into our podcast. Until next week, we ask you keep growing, you keep developing, you keep challenging yourself inside this game. We wish you and your club the very best, and thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball.